You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. Joining him is everyone's favorite coach and hair model, Chris, aka Tex McQuilkin, Power Athlete's Director of Performance. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Joe, let's take a moment to introduce and qualify your experience. John's shared his experience often on our show after 10 years, 700 episodes. But Joe, yeah, Wisconsin offensive lineman. We got first round, third pick overall in 2007, 11 years with Cleveland Browns, six-time All-Pro, 2010 All-Decade Team, and now 2023 Hall of Fame inductee.
Congratulations, dude.
Welcome to the show,
thank you,
sir.
Appreciate it. It's a deep pleasure for me to be on here. I've enjoyed catching up on your last few episodes, and I think we see eye to eye on a lot of things, so this will be a great show.
Thank you.
We got a range of things. Just doing some research, I learned you were a Titans game competitor. I must have missed that when the show was live.
That was miserable. That was really hard. It's like playing three NFL games in one day without trainers because it was made for TV. So like the people that set it up are not used to like having athletes competing and like busting their ass. And so we didn't even have band-aids. Like guys are getting shredded. Like guys are getting taken away in ambulances because you're basically doing a 3-minute competition all out at your VO2 max. And so guys are just falling over and freaking KO'd, getting carried away, and we have no trainers. All they had was like an EMT there. So after about
a week
of that,
dies, we can hit clear. That's about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. We'll make sure that the paperwork is filed correctly. Yeah. But we started to get some equipment at least. Like you have to crawl through these tiny little tunnels, and we were doing all sorts of real physical stuff where, especially as a big guy, it's me versus all these CrossFit champions, which was not exactly fair. We were supposed to be the pros and they were the Joes. But these fucking guys were 5'6" CrossFit champions, and we were crawling through these little rat tunnels. So it was definitely not in our favor. But at least after we started complaining, they gave us like some knee pads and some elbow pads and some like chalk and different like basic things that you would expect if you were doing a elite competition that would be kind of standard operation procedure.
Dude, I got roped into competing into the CrossFit Games in 2008. So it was my last year. I got done with the Chiefs, and I was you know, teams had reached out, but I hadn't signed with anybody. And then CrossFit just hits me up and it's like, hey, do you want to do this thing called the CrossFit Games? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'll go win this fucking thing. And then I show up and I'm competing, and it's like burpees and deadlifts against a guy that's 5'6", 135 pounds.
Exactly.
I got fucking, like, out of like 300 people, I think I finished like 70 something. I got absolutely decimated.
Oh, so the guy that eliminated me on Titan Games, I beat him the first time. And then you're just going through the same obstacle course twice. And the second time, he eliminated me. He was like the runner-up a couple years ago, CrossFit world champion, Matt Chan out of Denver, Colorado. Yeah. He's got like the world record for like the thruster, like the 135-pound thruster in a minute. Yeah. I'm like, you don't understand. I've trained my entire life for 3 to 5 seconds. Yeah. And then now you're asking me to do that level of intensity for 3 minutes against a guy that's body is perfectly tailor-made for this obstacle course. So I felt pretty good that I made it as far as I did, even though my kids were finally disappointed when I got eliminated. I had to come home and
see, Dad, if only you trained harder.
Yeah, they were such Matt Chan fans. It was funny. I actually bought a Matt Chan happy birthday cameo for them for their birthday because they were such fans of the guy that eliminated Dad.
Ah, that's awesome. Yeah, no, I actually know Matt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah, no, I mean, good dude. Yeah, after that, and then when I retired, I ended up working for CrossFit for a number of years.
Oh, so, okay, nice.
Yeah, I worked for them for, as a contractor for almost 9 years, teaching specialist seminars. Nice. So, yeah, I knew all the kind of the CrossFit superstars and worked in with Matt various times.
So it's true. He was a CrossFit almost world champion and much more well prepared than I was for the Titan Games.
I always wonder with some of those guys, like, and I don't mean to say, they kind of remind me of defense alignment a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, not the sharpest knives in the drawer because they just have to turn their brains off and suffer.
So yeah, that's right.
I always wonder if, like, maybe, like, the intellectual aptitude doesn't go as high as it should because they just, like, fucking just, yeah. So I make a lot of wisecracks, as you probably do, too, about how dumb defensive linemen are. We used to fool them constantly.
Yeah, see ball, get ball. Okay, I can do that. You're like, all right, now if this guy goes here, you got to change this blocking technique and do it a combination with him. Nope. See you later. Go to the other side of the ball. Well, they can't figure that out.
Or like even as simple as the linebacker going up and just tapping him on the hip, and you're like, you can't be fucking this dumb. And
Go that way.
Yeah. No. It's,
you can tell him like, hey, buddy, he's trying to tell you you're supposed to have that gap. By the way, I can see by the rotation of the safeties.
Yeah, and especially with the fact that you're cheating this way. No, it's, dude, we actually played with Hank Fraley.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So honey buns. Honey buns.
There you go. Thanks. Oh my gosh. Well, love that guy.
Trey Thomas gave him that nickname.
Yeah,
because he was.
So were you in Philly then? When okay, that's great.
Yeah, so I played left guard for the Eagles, and then Bubba Miller got hurt, and they brought in Buns, and he was our young guy. And I call him like the crutch boy, the fact that I had to fucking save his fucking skin. And then what's hilarious is obviously whatever we did worked, because then he went to play for you guys and was fucking killing people.
Yeah, man. He was awesome. And he's the type of guy you look at and you're like, you can't be an NFL player. But he was so smart. He was technically sound and he was really powerful.
Yeah.
For great feet. You know, I mean, he wasn't killing anybody in the weight room, but he knew how to use his body. He knew how to use leverage and he was super smart with it. He had a great career. And now he's the head offensive line coach for the Lions and he's doing great things. He's got one of the best offensive lines in the NFL right now.
Yeah. No, you know, Scott Peters, I don't know. He's one of
He's the assistant O-line coach, in Cleveland, and he came out as a consultant my last year in Cleveland. And I loved talking with Scotty. So smart. And he thought about offensive line play like I did. Like I despised the way offensive line coaches, kind of like in the Patriots system, where
you can
all they
just
did...
stop right there, just despising right, offensive line coaches. Like you didn't need to say any more for me.
All right, perfect. Well, Scotty, he's an O-line coach, so I'll give him a pass. But these guys, all they did is they taught you what they learned from their coach, who was their mentor, who learned from his mentor. So you were getting passed down techniques from like the 60s. And I'm like, guys, shouldn't we be thinking about this a little bit differently? Not only is the game different, but our bodies are a little bit different. Yeah. Like our training methods are different. Yep. So I kind of created my own technique based on like the fundamentals that I've been taught, but just like looking at players, looking at how the body moves, looking at defensive linemen and just trying stuff. Yeah. And that's how Scotty was. And so he's done a great job really revolutionizing the technique that O-linemen use when they're trying to move people, which is that's your job. You got to move humans. How are we going to do that the best?
No, he was, he was also one of our young guys and he got pretty fucked up. Blew his ankle out and all of a sudden we were like, I want to say it was like preseason and I'm like in like a special teams meeting and I look at the roster and I'm like, why are these names in red? And I was like, oh, those are the guys we're cutting tomorrow. And his name was red. Oh. And so then they were over there juicing him up being like, hey, we got to get you out there. You know, we want, you know, you got to make this team. And so I went to him after I saw it and was like, yo dude, don't go out there. Or go down pregame. So he hobbles out there literally in pregame, takes a fucking snap, falls back and fucking starts screaming. And they had to bring the card out for him. And as soon as he did it, all of a sudden the, and this was John Harbaugh, who was our special teams coach at the time, head coach for the Baltimore Ravens, just fucking looks at me and I just kind of shrug my shoulders because I was a rep. And he was one of our young guys and I didn't want him to get fucked. And they were, they were legitimately trying to fuck him.
Yeah. And I remember hearing a story. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So he gets, he ended up getting an injury settlement and went out. And then I used to go out to Arizona when he was doing a bunch of grappling and working with those guys in the Lions Den. And he started talking to me about a lot of his stuff. And all I told him was, you know, the system he's developing was good. And it was tailor made for like a dude like him who didn't like to use his head because he was a huge pussy. And he was like, fuck you, Wellborn. So I still talk shit to him constantly. At least once a month, awesome. I'll send him something. We go back and forth. So especially when he sees Runyon. When he sees Runyon, he's like, this motherfucker. He's like, I can't believe Runyon hands out the fines. The dirtiest fucking player ever in the NFL. And he's the fucking fine guy. He's the he's the warden.
Oh, man, the irony of the NFL. They're good at double talk. And every layer of the NFL is really good at hypocrisy.
Well, I did the same thing. So, like, when I came in, they were showing me film, and I remember saying to my offensive line coach, do you have any, like, 6'5" white guys that aren't 400 pounds? Because they were just kept showing me these 6'8", like, 350-pound black dudes. And I'm like, you got any guys that look like me? So then he showed me, like, Jim Lachey and Zimmerman and was it Jumbo Elliott and a lot of those dudes and I'm like, okay, so vertical sets and set 2/3 inside out, big punch, move your feet, sounds perfect. And like that was exactly how I played. And I was like, dude, I'm not gonna jump everything, I'm more athletic than that. We were watching all this Green Bay film where it was like Adam Zimmerman jumping everything because he couldn't fucking move through space. So I'm like, I just played guard like a tackle and then just basically big punch, stay 2/3 inside out and just fucking drive your feet once you get into a position.
Yeah.
And And I remember like arguing with them. I'm like, okay, you guys are all just teaching some bastard Howard Mudd system. And you guys have no fucking idea what you're teaching. And more importantly, and then you're trying to build system off of genetic freaks. Mm-hmm. You know, you got like, you know, Tark Glenn or, you know, Willie Rofe, for example. Like, you're going to watch Willie Rofe and do Willie Rofe. Are you out of your mm-hmm. fucking mind? You know, so there was just a lot of like stuff that didn't add up for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that to your point, offensive line coaching should be like training in the weight room. It shouldn't be one size fits all. It shouldn't be, let's take the biggest, baddest dude ever and just do what he did, because there's probably a big genetic component that maybe you're not accounting for when you're just telling me, hey, go do what Jonathan Ogden did, or go do what Willie Rofe did, or go do what Walter Jones did. I'm like, dude I came in to the NFL at 300 pounds. Like, I'm 6'7", and he's like at least 2 or 3 inches taller than me.
I was standing next to J.O. He's like 6'9", like every bit of like 365. Like, yeah. I was like, oh my God. Like, this is the biggest dude ever, and you're going to show me picture, like video on JL?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and so I was a 300-pound tackle, so I was kind of undersized, and I gained some weight during my career as you get older and you hit your 30s, which is helpful as a lineman. But they were asking me at the beginning of my career to vertical set every time. Like, no change-up, no jump sets, no three-step shorts, nothing but vertical, and just let these 300-pound defensive ends just run right down your throat. And I got really good at anchoring and using my leverage and my power and my hips, but it was a godsend at the end of my career when I was allowed to change my set and do some different things and play the mind games with him, because I'm like, I'm not built like J.O. I'm not 360 pounds and I'm not just absorbing and saying, hey, run into me all day. This is where I'm feeling at my most comfortable. So I think that now you're having coaches like Scottie Peters and Bill Callahan from the Browns and Bob Wiley, where guys are actually looking at different body types and saying, hey, maybe the one system that I like to teach is not best for everybody. Let's find a system that works for you and allow us to individualize what your technique is based upon what your strengths are.
Shocker. I mean,
weird. Yeah, what a concept.
Dude, this might be too far out, but you know, something that I've told these guys for years about the NFL, they are so steeped in like history and what came before. Yeah. I mean, like, look at the combine. Like, mm-hmm. all of a sudden COVID hits, they don't do the combine. The NFL was fine. Like, they cut training camp and it was fine. And it didn't implode. It still went on. We had a Super Bowl, everything was fine. And then, I mean, so when I came in the NFL, my first year was 99. We had a bye-in preseason. So we were in training camp for over 40 days.
Oh, my God.
And it was pads, special teams. So it was 2 3-hour grinders, and then you had a 3-hour grinder in the morning, and then special teams. And we did that for roughly 42 days, I think, is what it came out to be. And, like, you know, and then I go play for Dick Vermeil, which was just a baton death march every single day. And then all of a sudden they change it, and they're like, you know, these guys can hit, what, like, maybe go in pads 5 times a year now.
Yeah.
And the NFL's still great, and it's still been fast. And they were so nervous that, like, if we didn't absolutely decimate these dudes. I remember after the new CBA, I remember Tony Gonzalez called me from Atlanta, and he's like, dude, we could have played 30 years.
I know.
With this new deal. And he's like,
yes.
And these coaches were so steeped in the, like, this is how we did it. I mean, down to offensive play, offensive line play and everything else, that, like, it almost, I just couldn't understand. It was such a, like, just dumb mentality that they weren't wanting to, like, evolve and try something different. And I love the fact that they brought in who's the cat from the Rams, a young coach,
Sean McVay.
Yeah, Sean McVay, and all these young dudes that are like, you know, we didn't grow up sweeping the floor. We don't have to do the same way you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. The NFL, especially when you were in, but even my first few years before they got rid of two-a-days, was still so much attached to the way they did it in the 40s and the 50s and the Bear Bryant and the Junction Boy days, and how they used to beat these guys into a pulp. But I'm like, those linemen were like 220 pounds. They can withstand 3-hour practices beating their heads against each other because there's not as much mass. There's not as much force going into each other's bodies. But, like, now we're all 300 pounds. We're very highly trained because we do this year round. This is our job. We're not going and working as plumbers in the off season. We probably don't need 6 straight weeks of 2-a-days of beating each other into a pulp because we don't need the conditioning. And we're so much bigger, faster, and stronger now that these hits are so much more decimating to our bodies and our joints. And all of a sudden, as they started backing off the amount of contact and they added more walkthrough and more mind type things in the training, now we see guys that are playing to their 40s and we're amazed, like, oh, what's going on? How are these guys playing so long these days? I'm like, well, it's because you didn't murder them their first 10 years in the NFL with 6 hours of on the field hitting where you're doing three spot drill, then 9-on-7, and then you're doing inside run, then you're doing outside run, then you're doing one-on-one run block. I mean, I get it. Like, you technically, with the run blocking specifically, it's probably not developing as quickly because you're not getting quite as many contacts, but the game is expanding to where it's now a game of how do we spread them out more and get guys in space and use athletes, which is a more exciting game to me to watch. I know, you know, the Dick Vermeils of the game probably are like, oh, I wish it was still 21 and 22 personnel and 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Like, that's what I wish football used to be. But like, for the average fan, they're going, let's spread them out. This passing stuff is kind of fun. It's kind of fun watching these athletes move in space.
You know, having played in Philly, I mean, it was NFC East, black and blue division. I mean, they called it like, I mean, like the turnpike. Like, we were going to go up and play the New York Giants in the Meadowlands. We were going to run the ball down their throat, inside zone, power, maybe a little outside zone, sprint right option, and then fucking straight down their throats. And we knew it was coming. And even with Dick Vermeil, same thing. We're going to go inside, outside zone, a little bit of sweep, a little bit of power, and then just try to fucking tee their heads off. And, you know, and now it's like when I look at a lot of the offensive line play as these guys zone, they're just literally just trying to block dudes and like not trying to necessarily drive guys off the ball, get in front of them, spread it out. And then, you know, because they have such a – I mean, the defenses are in such an interesting position because, one, they can't hit the quarterbacks. Two, you know, I mean, they're not basically killing the receivers over the middle. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, if you were a tight end or a receiver that went across the middle, you're going to lose your head. I watched Timmy Houck end Michael Irvin's career. I watch dudes absolutely just get decimated, and it doesn't exist. So it makes it such a more exciting game. And then especially for offensive line play, it seems that like, hey, dude, like, let's spread these guys out. They're already in a defense or in a like a pass set mentality. And if we got to run the ball, we're just going to, you know, depend upon the athleticism of the running backs. I think it's great.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing a lot more of the judo wrestling ideology come into line play where, hey, I'm going to use his momentum and his speed against him. I'm going to get him running in one direction. Now I'm just going to take him further and farther than he wants to go and allow the running back to find his own hole rather than saying, all right, it's a B-gap run. This is where the ball is going to run, and now we just need the biggest, strongest, toughest, dumbest motherfucker that we can possibly find to smash his head against another big, tough, dumb motherfucker and try to give us 6 inches of a gap for the running back to plow through for 3 yards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I played on that. I mean, you're going to put your head here between the man and the ball, and you're going to try to fucking knock him out. And we did that for years. And, you know, but then you get a situation where you get dudes killing themselves, and you have all these issues, and it had to evolve. It could not continue to go. And I still get people that are like, oh, it's not real football. I'm like, yeah, but that real football resulted in Junior Seau killing himself. I mean, my first year at the Pro Bowl, you know, Junior basically fucking attached himself to my hip and proceeded to drink me under the table every single night.
And then put it on your tab too, probably.
dude, and then the crazy part, he poured me into a limo. We went back home at 3 a.m. I got up to go on the balcony and puke, and I saw him running by on the beach. And all I could think of is like, that dude is a fucking warrior. And then I realized he couldn't sleep. You know,
really?
So
no shit.
Yeah, his brain was, you know, everything, like, it was, he was just medicating it, couldn't sleep, and was having all these problems, and just played it off with a big smile. So I think when you have those issues, like, you got to make a change. And you know, just, you know, and as you know, I'm sure a lot of your teammates just extremely impulsive, doing crazy shit, and you're like, fuck, dude. I mean, were these the type of individuals to do this job, or is this something that happened over the course of their career that's allowed them to kind of, you know, maybe not make the best decisions in life? I don't know.
Well, Seau leads me to one of my questions. John shared his welcome to the NFL moment, and John, you can share that in a moment after this question, but Joe, did you have a welcome to the NFL moment where it was this leap from college speed to game speed, or was there a person, a linebacker, a mentor that put you in check that sent you on this Hall of Fame trajectory?
Yeah, I think my welcome to the NFL moment was the first game of my NFL career. We're playing the Pittsburgh Steelers. We're at home. It's me versus James Harrison, who I didn't really know who he was because he was just starting to have that career ascension where then the next year he was NFL player, defensive player of the year, but played a good game. He still had a couple sacks. It was one of those quarterback kind of hangs onto the football a little bit too long. So I think overall my coach was happy with the way I played, but the welcome to the NFL moment was not me going against James Harrison, which was enough of a brain beat down with that little muscled head. But it came at halftime, which we had Charlie Fry. He was our starting quarterback. He was our captain. He'd been the team leader all year. Halftime, first game of the year, he's benched. He threw like two picks in the first half. They benched him. Then the next day we show up at the facility, and the first thing that our head coach Romeo Crennel says in the team meeting is, you may have seen on the news, but we have traded Charlie Fry to the Seattle Seahawks for a sixth round draft choice, and Derek Anderson's our new starting quarterback. And I'm like,
dude, remember this.
I'm like, this is the NFL?
No, this is Cleveland.
They're like, no. Yeah, this is what happens in Cleveland.
Yeah, this even is at that point. Yeah, this is what happens. Oh, fucking Romeo.
Well, they want to run, right? Anderson led to the playoffs.
We almost made the playoffs. Actually, it turned out to be a pretty savvy switch because Charlie never really had a super successful NFL career. He's kind of a backup for a little while. But Derek ended up winning us 10 games that year, and we almost made the playoffs. He made the Pro Bowl, and that was ended up being kind of like the highlight of my NFL career because out of 11 seasons, it was the only season that we finished with a winning record.
Fuck, dude. Goddamn. I totally remember that. I remember turning on ESPN and seeing the ticker and being like, holy shit, like Cleveland, what the fuck?
Yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, starting quarterback, captain.
Yeah,
see ya.
Yeah, we needed to make a change. We couldn't figure this out in training camp. And,
right.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I've told these guys, but we were playing San Diego at home. And, you know, we'd worked all week. You know, basically Junior had zero responsibility. Like, there were 10 dudes on the field, and we basically called it a cat defense, where he just basically was the cat that was trying to kill the mouse. And so I'm playing left guard, and all of a sudden, I know we're basically running a sweep to the right, and I know I'm like, you know, we're basically working off of this five. I got, like, I think it was like a five and a shade, and I'm like, oh, dude, I got Junior. I'm seeing him. All of a sudden, he walks out on the receiver. And, like, I mean, he's 20 yards from maybe 30 yards from the side. Like, he couldn't have been farther from the sideline.
Yeah.
Ball snaps, they toss it, and I take off running, and he somehow, and I was running as fast as I could, ran over the top and made the play on the other sideline. And he gets up and pats me on the butt and goes, welcome to the NFL, kid. And I was like, I still mathematically do not know how he did that. I mean, like, I had the angle. I was running this way. He was here. He ran over the top. And all of a sudden, I'm kind of, like, running, watching him. And he, like, hit an extra gear and just beat me over the top for the play. And, like, we're watching it in film. And I'm just like, you know. And he just, and then the worst is he patted me on the butt. And then and then that was a couple years later. I'm at the Pro Bowl. And he like, sees me and is like, you're with me. And then he basically relived the story and would tell people the story. Be like, you know what? And then, yeah. So it was great. And, so he gave me two of my welcome to the NFL moments. That and drinking me under the table for a week. It was fucking terrible.
Back when they used to have the Pro Bowl in Hawaii and they used to stay at the Ihalani Hotel. Yeah. It was just only Pro Bowl players and their family. That was so much fun. And I think they destroyed the Pro Bowl themselves when they moved it to Orlando and Florida and Miami, because then nobody wanted to be there. Half the guys already live in Florida anyway, and they don't want to take time out of their off season to go play in the Pro Bowl if it's not really feeling all that special. But Hawaii felt special. That was a really cool experience, having that out there and bringing all those guys together where they could drink all the rookies under the table and then put all the
and then make us pay
for tabs on their rooms.
No, it was great. Like, I got to the end and I was like, I look at my room bill and I'm like, ooh, I guess we're paying for this one. It was a great time. But the other part too is, you know, they set it up in such a way that, like, you know, there was interaction with the fans, but then there was like you were just kind of like sequestered away.
Yeah.
Where you could go out to the pool, have a good time. You were on the beach, you know, and it wasn't like it is today. But also, right. You know, I mean, this is really before the advent of social media, which didn't really kick off until the, you know, 2010s, which is another thing I was going to ask you. You know, when you came in the league, social media really wasn't a thing. And then towards the end of your career, I mean, 2017, social media was such a big thing.
Yeah.
Like, how did that change in terms of the fan interaction and you and dealing with the media? Was it better or worse?
I felt really fortunate that when I came into the NFL, it was newspaper and TV and radio, and that was it. Like, there was no Twitter. There was Facebook, but it wasn't really used the way it was now. It was more just about, you know, connecting your friends. That was it. And it was great because even though we didn't have a lot of success, I had a lot of good coaches that gave me great wisdom. And I was always the guy that was sitting in the front row with the big notebook taking notes of everything I heard because, well, I'm not really good at paying attention unless I'm writing things down. So it was just a way for me to kind of pay attention to meaning, but I really absorbed a lot more of that knowledge. And Romeo Crennel was the one that told me, he's like, first thing you want to do as a rookie, just turn off the TV, don't get the newspaper, cancel all that, because none of that shit matters. It's rat poison if you're doing a great job and they tell you you're doing a great job, because they're always going to tell you you're better than you really are doing, and they're always going to tell you you're worse than you're really doing. The only voice that matters is the voice of the coaches in these rooms. And I actually took that to heart, because you know, it's really easy to get down in the dumps in the NFL when you're losing, when you're not having success, because everybody piles on. And then the same thing happens on the way up. Like, if you're playing well and you're doing good things, all of a sudden you think your shit don't stink, and then you're not going to improve. You're not going to be grinding for perfection, because everybody wants to tell you how great you are. And so I kind of had that mentality early on in my career. So when social media came on board with Twitter and then Instagram, like, I didn't even join the platform until my last year in the NFL, until I realized that, hey, I'm going to do something in my post-career life that will probably need an Instagram and a Twitter account. I don't know what that's going to be, but it probably would be a good idea while I'm still a professional athlete to at least get it and gather some of those followers, so that then I can use those platforms with whatever I decide to do when I retire. So I felt like I was really lucky. And I think you're actually starting to see some tide turn a little bit on the social media stuff with pro athletes, where the guys are realizing how much poison it is and how much more money you can make if you just turn it off and focus on, how do I be the best pro athlete, the best left guard, the best football player that I possibly can be? It's going to be so much more productive, rather than listening to the yayas that have never played even high school football tell you how great you're doing or how shitty you're doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, just the fan interaction. I'm constantly amazed. I mean, obviously, you know, like, fans were always around and I was always happy to meet them. Mm-hmm. It's a lot different when they're at training camp and you meet people face to face or whatever. But then all of a sudden when they're behind, you know, the veil of social media, like the ugly shit people say, I'm like, it's really added an interesting element to this. And then also the, you know, I mean, because there's a ton of betting and whatnot, just the fact that people are so into what people's social media, trying to find some edge for it. I'm like, the other one I was laughing about is, I was kind of going through some of the NFL stuff. I can't believe how many of these dudes are getting busted for gambling on apps.
Oh my gosh. It was just a couple of weeks ago that guys were suspended, I want to say like for a year, for betting on like college football on like some type of sports app. Like, I'm not a gambler. I can't gamble because I work for NFL Network, and I'm not really a gambler as it is. But like, they're just betting on college football, like fantasy or something like this, and getting suspended for a year. Yeah. I mean, PED violations are 4 games. If you try to rip somebody's helmet off and beat them with it, it's like 6 games. But if you gamble on college football, a $50 parlay, it's a full year. So it's amazing how hard of a stance the NFL has taken on some of this gambling stuff. But I kind of understand it, because it's such a huge revenue stream for them, and they don't want to poison that well whatsoever with any suspicions about players throwing games or throwing bets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always had people, I'm sure you've had people ask you, like, oh, is there, you know, did you ever think any of the players, I actually had somebody ask me this question. I'm like, the players couldn't fix a game. There's no fucking way. The way
no,
they
it's
fix
not
it,
like basketball or baseball.
The only way they fix a game is through the refs. Like, the refs are the only one. And there was shit that would happen where I was always like Spock eyebrow, where I remember we were playing Green Bay in the first round of the playoffs, and we had like an 18 play drive. We had 3 TV timeouts in that 18 plays. In the cold, like in Green Bay in January, at night, and they kept, like, we were fucking killing them, and then they called like TV timeout, and they're like 2 to 3 minutes, and then we're just standing out there chilling, and then we kept fucking running the ball. They called another one, and then we got to the red zone. They called the third, and we're just like, and Runyon started screaming. He's like, "The fucking fix is in. They don't want us to beat them," you know. And so whenever
the guy that's working for the NFL now,
as they're fucking the fine guy, I'm like, "God damn you, Runyon,
the congressman, and now works for the NFL."
Oh shit, yeah, no, but that was like I always said, dude, if there was gonna be a fix, it would be somewhere between the refs and whoever calls down from the magic box to like tell them these things. Cause I'm sure you've seen it where like all of a sudden a call gets reversed or something and you're just like, what the fuck are they looking at?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's times now, especially that they have the microphone in their ear where they're picking up a flag or they're dropping a flag and you're like, that didn't just come out of ether. Like, that came from somewhere. Somebody told you to do that. And certainly, I think if you're the gambling person, you're like, all right, quarterbacks and running backs, they may be able to influence the game negatively, right? They're obviously not going to be able to do anything positively because they're already trying probably as hard as they can.
Sure.
But like the people upstairs in the skybox that are calling down to the refs, the sky judges and the refs. That would be the place that I would be the most concerned if I was an official or an NFL official. I wouldn't really care about anybody else, because what is an offensive lineman going to do? As soon as I give up two sacks, I'm out of the game anyway.
Yeah, so and then you're really cut on Monday.
Yeah, then I'm sitting home with my family. No matter how big that bet was, they're going to be real pissed at me that I'm not making my NFL salary anymore.
Yeah, no, it's I'm totally with you on that.
Is fantasy in bounds? Like, not affiliated with money, or live players allowed to just participate in free fantasy football?
I think you can play fantasy football. I'm not into that fantasy football either. I just got so much other shit going on. My wife plays a little fantasy, and she doesn't play for money, but there's like a couple $100, I think, with her friends at the end of the year that you win. And so I'm not sure with NFL players if they're allowed to play fantasy with no dollars attached to it or not. But also, how much fun would that? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it just seems like it wouldn't be that much fun if there was nothing on the line. Maybe there's like, hey, you got to get a tattoo of my face on your ass or something like that.
I mean, which would also be a good bet.
Yeah, that's my college buddy's bet.
Which maybe there is a way to put something on the line without it being monetary.
Yeah, no, I mean, they were all pretty, I mean, like, you know, when you come in the NFL, like, especially in training camp, they do kind of a securities deal where they're like, hey, you know, like, use a condom. You know, don't marry hookers or strippers. I mean, like, they always come in and say all this stuff. And one of the big ones was like, stay away from gambling if people want to buy you dinner, just like, especially in Philly. But I remember after the season, we had our annual NFL or offensive line kind of like party deal in Vegas. And we were out there having a pretty good time. And I sat down at the table with, I believe he played for the Cleveland Browns, a guy named Ross Verba.
Yeah.
Remember Ross?
Yeah, I remember that name. Never played with him, but I remember the name from when he was in Green Bay, because I was a big Packer fan growing up in Wisconsin, and he was, I want to say, the right tackle there before he went to Cleveland.
Yeah, so he was sitting there, and I sat down, and I'm not a good gambler. Like, I like to shoot craps, and, like, if I lose $10, I'm like, oh, I'm all right. Like, I just don't like to lose money. Like, I work too hard for it. And so I sit down, and he's like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm up, like, you know, five or six. Yeah, I think I was, like, up $500 or something. I'm like, I'm, like, up five. I'm like, how are you doing? He's like, I'm down seven. And I was like, oh. And then they, like, came over, and he signed this slip, and they put all these, like, 1,000 chips in front of him, and I realized he was down 700K.
Oh my God.
And I was up like $500.
And you were pumped.
And I was fucking excited. I got like a free deal. Shit. They were going to like comp my dinner. I'm like, yeah, I got $500. I got some dinner. You know, I don't know. Like, I just mentally couldn't wrap my head around playing. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you're a billionaire, it'd be nothing. But like, shit, that's a lot of dough. And they brought him over, and he was already in the hole 700, and they had just basically squared him like another 250.
Jesus.
And he was hoping to go on a run. And I was like,
okay. I'm going to slide over here. Yeah. Homer Simpson.
Dude, like, I just disappeared into the weeds. But man,
both of you have had interaction with professional athletes and still seen some things like gambling and alcohol, different pulls away from the game. Now we see with the NIL, money is entering into 18 to 22 year olds who have less experience and more draw towards those pulls. Joe, what are your feelings about NIL? Is it a position to be a good thing for these athletes, and you've been a top college athlete, or a negative thing potentially?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. We were just shitting on social media before, but there are some good things that have come out of it, right? Like, you lose your privacy. And back when I started, when you played, John, you had this privacy where you could go out, you could make really bad decisions at night with drugs and alcohol and strippers, and it wasn't going to get out there. Like, nobody found out about it unless you didn't show up for practice the next day and you got suspended or the coach reprimanded you or whatever. So players and really public figures were able to get away with all this stuff for a long time. And so the bad decisions snowballed, and you got so many old school NFL guys who tell these crazy ass stories about their lifestyle and how, of course, that affects the way that they play on the field. And then, you know, it catches up to you when you're 50 and 60 and 70 years old. But players can't get away with that now because of social media, right? No matter where you go, somebody's got a camera phone and they're taking a video or a picture of you. So players are much more sheltered and they stay at home more. And I think they really focus on their craft a lot more because they don't have as much draw to go out and party as they used to. And so I think that's probably been a positive. I don't know if it's a net positive when you consider all the negative of social media. But with NIL, I think it is going to be a really good thing. I think first and foremost with NIL, it was criminal, actually criminal. I'm using the term the way I feel, to be able to say this group of players, because you play a sport, are not allowed to own your name, your image, or your likeness. We own it if you play for us. And by the way, there's nowhere else to go because we have a monopoly. Who are you going to go play college football for? Not the NCAA. We've already created a cartel that you have to play for us if you want to play football. Yeah. And then that was basic violations of human rights. Like, yeah. If I'm a musician, if I'm an entertainer, like, I own all of the things that is me. And if I want to go sell it to somebody for $50 or $50,000 or $5 million, that's my right to make that decision. That's not the school's right. It's not my coach's right. That's not the NCAA's right. So fixing just the humanity portion of it, I think, is good. But as far as NIL goes, I think it's going to give players some incentive, especially the top guys, to stay in school a little bit longer, because you have an opportunity to create some wealth and some money. I mean, how many guys, John, did you hear, hey, I had to go pro, even though I was going to be a fourth or fifth round pick because my family at home needs money. Yeah. We're in a tough spot, like whatever that is. And you're literally playing for snacks. Like, yeah, you get a scholarship, but would a lot of these guys even go to school if they weren't on scholarship playing sports? Yeah. Maybe, maybe not. But you can't monetize a scholarship. So you're sitting there, you're getting your $10 per diem after games. They pay for your housing and they give you snacks. And then you get a tiny little stipend and you're supposed to live on that. And you're beyond a broke college kid because you can't work. Yep. Like, if you don't have any family money, if your parents aren't giving you any money, it's not like you're able to go make a little bit like the other college students are to go live on, to go buy a dinner or have a beer or buy some clothes for yourself. So you're poorer than a college student normally is.
We were so far below the poverty line.
It's unbelievable.
Like, yeah, like dudes are like, we should be getting welfare.
We would qualify.
I worked security for illegal raves in San Francisco. So we got hooked up, like we were like totally under the table, you know, $300 cash to basically just show up and watch these kids completely just like take ecstasy and drugs and just melt down like poor little robots that would just dance themselves and go crazy and then just like pass out. And then we would like see them, we'd get our money and we would run. I'd be like, I don't know if these kids are dead or not. And that's how we made extra check. And I came home. I mean, my scholarship check was $740, rent was $475. My mom and dad gave me a couple hundred extra bucks. So like $300 to us was like, we're rich. We're going to get sushi. So, I mean, and then, you know, I mean, training table improved. But like at the time, we only got training table one meal during the season. And now they have training table all year round. I mean, it's such a better situation for these guys.
Right.
But like, we were legitimately like, I mean, we looked at it. We were like, everybody, I mean, as you know, dude, like in college towns, you're like, there's $1 beers. There's $2 wings.
Yep.
You know, you kind of like knew where to go to kind of navigate this thing.
Yeah.
South Park had an incredible skit about this NIL where Cartman goes in. Did you ever see this? And he's like, how do I get your slaves? And the NCAA is like, they're not slaves. And he's like, okay, you're players. And he's like winking. And he's like, I want to buy in on these
student
slaves.
Athletes.
Yeah, student athletes. Yeah,
student, I love it. Yeah, they're very, dude, very sure to make them student athletes.
Oh, dude, Cartman's thing. And he's like, they're not slaves. And it's true, man. I mean, like, I'm super excited that these kids get an opportunity to make money. They don't have to struggle as bad. But also on the other side of me, the purest of it, being like, you know, would people have worked as hard as they did if the payday wasn't in front of them? You know, I mean, I played with some really talented players that, you know, the day they got paid, they never ran again. They never worked hard again. Like once they got their payday, they were like, fuck this. And I wonder, like, I don't know if it would have been, I know it wasn't for me because, I just wanted to go out there and fucking beat people's asses. I didn't give a shit about the money. I just wanted to go out and fucking beat wholesale ass. So, but there were a lot of dudes where like the money was everything. And once they got it, like the incentive fell out. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if in college, you know, those kids are so young. I don't know if they have like a little, I mean, just take a look at boxing, for example. It's usually the most oppressed people at the time tend to be the best boxers. I mean, if you look, it was like early in America, it was the Italians and the Jews and the Irish. And then it became, you know, obviously the blacks. And then you get like Mexicans and you get kind of these different groups that are kind of on the bottom of the socioeconomic always tend to be the best boxers because they're fighting out of something. You know, that's why like the Tyson Fury, like white, you know, I mean, gypsy kind of that culture. You know, ascends to it. So I just wonder if like there's part of that is a little bit lost by these kids getting their juice and they're getting their cheese so early. But then also, you know, I was looking at, I saw a whole thing on the little expose on the Cavender sisters that were at, and were there at Fresno and then they went to Miami and like the amount of money they made. I mean, like, they do something like 30 pieces of content a day on like TikTok and all the social media. And I was like, no fucking way. I clicked through it. It's ridiculous. I'm like, I was like it reminds me of like the dancing chicken underneath the plate. And like, I mean, I realize they're getting paid, but they were about to, there was some shady shit that they did.
Yeah.
And they pretty much were going to be suspended for their final year. So they just basically left school early and went and joined the WWE.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so I mean, they navigated it well, but it's like, I just think it's like they're going to have to do something to regulate it, whether it's, hey, we see this money, you're going to have to put it in an escrow account. We'll give you a stipend, but you're not going to have access to this $3 million. Like you can put it in something, like they're going to have to put something in place, because it just doesn't make sense to give 18-year-old kid athletes access to that much cash. Just as a parent, as you know, I'm a parent as well.
Yeah.
I just don't think the kids have the wherewithal at that age to be able to manage that.
Yeah. I think it's going to be really good for female athletes and for non-revenue sport athletes, right? Because those are the guys that are going to be making potentially millions of dollars in pro football, basketball, baseball, et cetera. But like, I was on the track team in college. I married a basketball player, female, in case you're wondering. And like,
we didn't want to assume any gender. Okay. Yeah, I know
you don't want to assume in today's day and age, but, and I got three daughters and a son, and for them to potentially in college, like they could be the biggest celebrities on campus. Like I live in Madison, Wisconsin. Our volleyball team won the national championship. They have an enormous following. Like their volleyball players are the most famous people on campus. And for them to be able to monetize that a little bit right now is phenomenal, because they'll never have an opportunity down the line with a professional career the way they could possibly right now. So I think that's really good. But to your point, the NIL system, especially because it's new, it's not perfect. I'm not arguing that this is the perfect system, and it's going to continue to be tweaked. It's going to be changed, whatever those looks like. I think that's going to be good for it in the long run. And it's going to need it. But that's like with anything in the world. Like, when's the first time you roll out this enormous platform like that and it's just perfect from day one? That just never happens. It's always going to get changed and it's always going to be tweaked. And I think when we look back 10 years from now, even the harshest critics are going to say, you know what, in the end, I think this was good for the athletes. It was good for college sports. And there was no way we were going to be able to continue to hold these slaves, I mean, student athletes, to the status quo for the rest of eternity, especially with the advent of social media and their ability to monetize their brand directly to fans.
Yeah, no, I'm in complete agreement. I think they have to put something in. The other part of this, though, is also the transfer portal. That's another part I have is like, you know, I mean, think about it. I mean, even as a young college player, I'm sure there was a moment where, I don't know, maybe you walked in day one and started. I didn't start until my second year. And my first year, when I redshirted, like, I mean, shit, dude, they were like, you know, I don't think I was told one positive thing for those first couple of years. I mean, my coach was like such a fucking asshole. Yeah. Like the amount of like attacking and negative reinforcement. Like, I mean, we just persevered through it and then you end up being okay. But like now I think like if a coach talked to a player like that, he would have transferred them like within 2 seconds. Yeah. We just had nowhere else to go. And I think sometimes, you know, I mean, I wish football was a kind and gentle place, and I don't know how you forge football players in like a kind and gentle way. At least maybe the way that, or maybe the game's evolved where you can. But I know that these coaches are in a precarious situation, because how are they hard on these kids to be able to get them to do this, but like not so much so that the kid's butthurt enters transfer portal because, you know, my coach was mean to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm sort of a libertarian, and I'm like, the market will take care of it, right? Like, hey, you know what? If you show up at day one and your coach is an asshole and he does suck, like, that's good. I want his players to transfer out so that everybody else that's on the outside sees he's a shitty coach and that he should lose his job, and they should find different methods to get the most out of these players. And I also believe that over time you're going to find, hey, the best coaches, they've found a way to get the most out of these players in a good, meaningful way that doesn't maybe destroy the mentality of the person. And you know what? Other players are going to see the success that this coach is having, putting guys in the NFL, making millions of dollars, creating great young men. And that's going to be important to the recruits, to the recruits' parents. They're going to see it just the same way we saw, hey, at Wisconsin, Jim Huber's a really good offensive line coach. I want to go play for him because he can develop me potentially into an NFL player. And so I think it's important to have that transfer portal so that the teams are holding up their end of the bargain. Now, I totally understand, like, you're going to have guys that are just going to bail at the first chance they get if they get yelled at or if they get demeaned.
Or the first sign of like adversity.
First sign of adversity or when things are tough. But you know what? That guy's going to go in the transfer portal and maybe nobody's going to pick him up because that coach is probably going to get a call from the next coach wondering, hey, tell me about this guy. Why did he leave? And he says, well, he's kind of a wussy. I don't think he'd fit in your system. Now that player is in the transfer portal and he just weeded himself out, right?
Yeah, sure.
It's a survival of the fittest type situation where you're actually selecting for the players that want to be there, the players that it's important to get the best out of themselves and be the best version of themselves. So I think over time, the market corrects for progress and for better value on the coaching and the playing side. And the transfer portal is a way to do it because the coaches have been able to do it for a long time. They can leave whenever they want. They can upgrade their situation. And so not holding the players to the same situation that the coaches are in, where they can leave if the organization's not holding up their end of the bargain that they thought when they signed on the dotted line, they can get out of there.
Dude, that's an excellent perspective. I was just like, I think it was yesterday, I was reading a little bit about the soap opera that is Colorado with Deion Sanders.
Oh, yeah.
And I love the disingenuous nature of Deion trying to be this fucking hard ass and this whole thing, because that wasn't him as a player.
I was going to say, do you remember when Deion was asked to tackle?
No, because
he never tackled anybody.
No. And dude, one of my fucking favorite moments in the world was, you know, we were pretty notorious about, I don't know if you ever saw us. When we were in Philly, we had a straight up, I'm not going to call it a bounty, but there was a monetary investment system for late hits around the pile. And especially like picking dudes off, running downfield.
Yeah.
If like the ball carrier goes down, like there was fines if you weren't in the screen, if you took pick the dude, like we had a whole fucking deal. And then they started just fining us like $20,000 in preseason for a history of violence. And that shit kind of ended. But we were playing the Cowboys, and I came fucking screaming up to the pile, and Deion made the mistake of jogging, and I fucking feared, and I fucking teakettled him. And he got up and was fucking freaking out. I ain't trying to hit anybody out here. What the fuck are you doing? You know, like, they don't pay me to tackle. I mean, you're on the field. You don't have your helmet buckled, and you're jogging around like you're going to get fucking lit up. So it's hard for me to hear Deion like talking about like toughness in these kids and the whole, and I'm just like, oh my God, dude, have you forgot who the fuck you are? And more importantly, if a coach had talked to you like this, you would have been the first one into the transfer portal. So it's so crazy that all of a sudden he's gone back and rewriting history and people are supporting it. And I kind of wanted to be like, I mean, shit, if I was on the NFL Network, I'd be like, let me tell you about my Deion experience.
Yeah, right.
This motherfucker.
I love that line. This motherfucker. That's how we always would start a conversation in our O-line room. We'd always start, this motherfucker.
Oh, that's standard how every fucking line would be like.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, so look at this motherfucker.
It's been handed down.
Yeah, this motherfucker.
Tradition older than Augusta.
Yeah, I mean, but like that's also kind of hilarious to me that a lot of players, and I'm sure you knew this too, guys you played with or other stuff, all of a sudden they get away from the game, and all of a sudden you're hearing this and you're like, yeah, that wasn't who you were. I realized that history has allowed you to do some shit, but dude, I know exactly where you were, motherfucker.
You see that in many professions, right? Navy SEAL, Allure, they come in and try to tell you how it is.
Oh, yeah, dude. I like listening to Booger McFarland talk to people about, unbelievable. I know you work for the NFL Network, so I don't want to expect you to say anything, but like, there's a lot of people out there. Damon Woody was another one talking about people's conditioning and this. And I'm like, Damon, you never worked out a single day in your life, dude. Like, so it's funny to me to have contemporaries, especially on TV, when they're pontificating about different players this, and knowing them as athletes and especially as players, I'd be like, listen here, dude, you don't want me to come on there and talk shit to you.
We can spin zone this. Is there a voice out there that represents who they were on the field that is now in the spotlight?
Yeah, I mean, shit, dude. I don't care what you say about Gronk or any of these guys. I mean, nobody played the game as well, as hard, and as much dedication as Tony Gonzalez. Like when Tony, and, you know, Tony's, I don't know if he's the best announcer. You know, he does good, like, in that, but, you know, he's good in the conversations and that. Like, I don't know if Tony's going to be sitting there, you know, giving you all the breakdowns, but in terms of, like, somebody sitting up there that has created the ethos that has the ability to talk about things. I played with him, and I don't think anybody took it as seriously with as much effort and played the game with that level of intensity to the point where I was like, shit, man, I'm playing with one of the greatest to ever do this job. So he was a great player in that way. Schlereth, it was another one. You know, Stink played the game extremely hard. I remember we were out and he's like, you know, I was pretty good. I just wanted to see how good I was when I could have surgeries too. You know, I had 29 surgeries. I mean, those guys, like those dudes played the game. So I tend to, for the guys that I knew that played the game the way I thought it should have been played, I put a lot. I mean, Randy Moss, I mean, he, you know, for Randy up there, I mean, shit, Randy was an absolute fucking killer. I mean, you know, you probably wouldn't have expected him to always do the right thing, but I think, like, in terms of going out and just trying to take scalps, I mean, Randy Moss was an absolute savage, too. Mm. Who was the other one? Michael Irvin's a little interesting one, but... yeah, just some of the guys. I mean, yeah. I mean, I like, for all the, you know, whether you had off-field drama or whatnot, maybe you weren't the best team guy or whatever, but dudes that go out and they strapped it up and they played as hard as they could with as much intensity and fucking dominated, those guys will forever have my respect. And when I see guys up there pontificating that didn't, and I know because I played against them, it's real hard for me to listen to it.
Yeah, so. I worked with Michael Irvin. I worked with Steve Smith at NFL Network, and both those guys, I respected them, how they worked, how they played with a different attitude and mindset than most receivers. And that's the same attitude that they approach their off the field work now that they're in media. I mean, nobody worked harder than Michael Irvin. Nobody was willing to go across the middle and sacrifice his body like Michael Irvin. And you don't even see those plays in today's game anymore because the safeties can't hit those receivers when they come across the middle. Same thing with Steve Smith. He was not a big receiver, but he was feisty. He was a little pit bull. He was a bulldog. He was going to mix it up. He was going to get his nose in there. He was willing to block. And those receivers that were willing to block were some of my best friends on the team, right? Because I had the ultimate respect because they didn't have to do that, right? Yeah. As a lineman, my only ability to stay in this seat is by blocking. So I don't really have a decision on whether I want to block or not. But for those guys, like, it was sort of optional. Like, if you could catch the ball, they didn't really care if you were going to block. They would ask you to, but they weren't going to hold you to it. But those guys that actually made it important to them because they realized how it would actually help them in the long run, they had my deepest respect. My podcast co-host, Andrew Hawkins, 5'6" receiver, like, he was one of the hardest blockers that I'd ever played with because it was important to him. And you can learn to block. Like, it's really just a desire thing. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing those receivers go in there and dig out those safeties because it means that I'm important to them. It's not just them and their catches. Like, me and my family and this team is important to them. And what they do, they realize it affects how I'm perceived, how my family is being fed, how our team has success or not has success. So to me, that's like the ultimate unselfish player is a receiver who's willing to go in there and block.
Yeah. No, I mean, especially too, if those guys have to come back and crack back on a dude and actually see a receiver like sell out and put his whole body into it, where you're like, especially a tackle, you're in your stands, you see a guy come crack on somebody and you're like, dude, I'm so hyped to watch this little dude kill people. But yeah, no, Steve Smith was, he played the game. That was actually at Philly when Michael Irvin came across and Timmy Houck fucking ended his career. Timmy was our safety, and he was Chuck Cecil's roommate.
Damn.
So, yeah, Tim is, I can't remember, he's DB's coach. I can't remember where he is in the NFL right now. But, yeah, he actually was like a...
I'm sure he tells that story every year.
Dude. Tim has probably done his best to, like, step away from the fact that he was just, like, the white missile. I remember we were in training camp, and he came on a safety blitz, and that dude hit me so hard that I was like, I don't know if I can see out of my right eye for about 10 minutes. That's a hard hit. And then later on, because we were buddies, I was like, I don't know if you should ever hit me that hard. He's like, what are you talking about? He just like, he's just literally would just hurl his body like a dead carcass at you. And he's like, I only have one way to go. He's like, there's no like, you're either going to get it or you're not. Like, I got no other switch. And I was like, okay, I'll make sure to get the fuck out of the way and Ola.
It's amazing guys like that, if they just turn it down a notch. Like, if you're playing in practice and, you know, maybe it's 75% or you're in spiders or whatever, and they try to dial it back, that's when they get hurt.
Yeah.
Like, because they don't know how to go slow and control their body except for if it's full kamikaze mode.
Do you think certain players lend themselves better to having a job in media post? Like, you know, I mean, for the most part, you see, like you know, I mean, Tony's a tight end, which, you know, I mean, Witten and some of those guys, but like, you really look, it's like quarterbacks, offensive linemen, maybe a receiver, maybe occasionally a DB. But for the most part, like, there seems to be certain positions that I like to believe are more cerebral and do a better job in terms of this format.
Yeah, I totally agree. And to me, it's positions that had to see the whole field. Like as an offensive lineman, I got to know where the safeties are. I got to know where the corners are. It's not just me versus the D lineman across from me. Like I have to see the big picture. So you have to kind of understand the chess match that's going on out there a little bit like a quarterback. But a lot of times those defensive guys, some of those other positions that we won't mention, they're just looking at one thing. Okay, where's the ball? Okay, I get the ball. And then they just turn their brain off. And that's, you know, maybe the extent of their cerebral nature. They can't really handle it.
They've been eating paint chips. They eat a lot of paint chips. That was our joke. Right. And be like, that guy eats a lot of paint chips.
Well, you mentioned you ran track with college. So this is something I'm learning now. You were a multi-sport level at college.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you a multi-sport level, multi-sport athlete growing up? And then are you going to push the same for your kids?
I am. Like you mentioned, I did shot put and discus in college for a couple years, and I loved it. It was a great contrast to like the meathead nature of football. And I think it actually allowed me to be a much better football player, because when you throw the shot and disc, it's extremely technical, and you're watching film of the tiniest little details to try to create a little bit more force through the ground. And you get instant feedback from, okay, put one 3 feet further or 3 inches further. And all I did was I changed this little thing. And so I took that attention to the minutia of my technique and I placed it on my football sport, my left tackle pass set, my left tackle run game, my zone steps. And I think that's why I sort of was a perfectionist and kind of helped tweak and develop my own technique that worked for me, that was individualized for my own body. And I think too many players, when they specialize early, what happens is it's like a battery. It's like just charging your battery up. Like you hit this wall that you can't get beyond, because the way the brain works is you constantly are looking at a problem or growth as an athlete. Or in this case, if you specialize, let's say you're just a quarterback and you hit that wall and all you can do is hit that wall over and over again. But if you play other sports and you're cross training, you're playing basketball, you're playing football, you're playing baseball, you're actually growing a bigger battery as you become a better athlete across mm-hmm. other sports. So now when you do start to focus and specialize on your one sport, now you have a bigger battery that you can charge up. You've got a brain that's allowed to have different pathways to get around problems and to think of things with different perspective and not just hear what my coach tells me and then go do what my coach tells me. And I think you see that with guys like Patrick Mahomes, right? The classic quarterback when I got in the NFL that John had when he was playing was drop back 5 or 7 steps, stand there, go 1, 2, 3 and throw the ball. Now you're realizing, hey, maybe if we get these quarterbacks outside the pocket, if they are scrambling, they're good athletes. They're able to run to their left and turn their body and off platform, throw like a shortstop and throw the ball 45 yards down the field to strike a receiver that's streaking down the middle of the field on a post route. Like, wow, that has tremendous value. Where did he learn that? Well, he was a great shortstop when he was in high school. He could have gone to Major League Baseball. That's who Patrick Mahomes is. And I think you're realizing the value by watching the way NFL players are changing and evolving in being a multi-sport athlete when they're younger. And that's one of the big beliefs at Sports Advantage, which is the youth performance training centers that we have, is we're just trying to build a better athlete. We're not trying to build a specialized athlete in any one thing, because the best thing you can do for your middle school, your elementary school, your high school kid, and even in college, I thought it was a huge benefit for me, is let them play as many sports as possible. Because when a player is having joy, when he's going out and he's competing, he's getting the most out of himself. He's training in that almost max effort range. Whereas as soon as he starts to specialize, brain gets a little bit bored, gets a little bit redundant. Now you're not getting any better because you're not training hard enough. You're not working hard. If you're not competing and getting the most out of yourself to become a better athlete.
Dude, I don't think I could have said it better.
Yeah, that was.
I mean, that was. Yeah,
In Texas, it's football is very political, so they hold playing time against you. You're not going to play basketball this year, or else you're not going to start at running back.
That's tough, man.
So they do hold it against you, and it's unfortunate. I coach high school lacrosse, so it's a club outside of the formal UIL, and that's a big motivator. Is I'm trying to help them gain their social intelligence, so they can have this conversation when it comes, because. No, I understand the value of, one, playing multiple sports, and two, just the potential to go play college sports. My guys are not the biggest. There's more opportunity for them to play college lacrosse than college football. So just creating the possibility and now helping them have this conversation when it's inevitable and their playing time is held against them.
Yeah. No, the ability to do something outside of football. I've always said, dude, if you want to develop football players, teach them some other skills, whether it be basketball, something that teaches you to move in space. For me, it was boxing. So I boxed from the time I was pretty young.
Interesting.
Boxed on the Cal boxing team. We went and trained with those guys in the offseason. And, you know, and then Roth, who was, you know, trained me when I was in the NFL, you know, he trained Antonio Tarver for his conditioning stuff. And, you know, Jimmy was fight coach. So, I mean, we did a ton of that. And just the ability to move through space, cut a guy off in the ring, you know, basically never square dude up, play two-thirds inside out. First meaningful touch, how to judge distance, I mean, how to understand, how to, like, you know, fake and move. I mean, all of those skills, I think, were more beneficial for me playing offensive line than actually any of the offensive line stuff I ever learned.
Yeah.
I mean, it was part of my deal. They were always like, you know, how are your hands fast? Because we fucking hit speed bags. We did all this. Mm-hmm. We jump rope. I mean, all the different things that I did in training for boxing ended up helping me be a better offensive lineman than I think the guys that were just training for offensive line. So I always think offensive line is a good culmination of a lot of other skills that you can kind of pour a little violence in. And then obviously if you're smart enough to pick up the playbook and understand how to, you know, where to be. I mean, as a big part of offensive line plays, you know, is, okay, where's the ball going? What's everybody else doing? All right, now how do I put myself in the way to be able to do my job? And it was always fascinating to me where guys be like, what's my assignment? I'm like, how about we start where the ball is going? You know, like if you know where the ball is going, there's a good way as long as you get your body between, even if you don't know what's going to happen, if you know where the ball is going, as long as I get my body between the defender and you know, put my body between the defender and the ball, you're going to get right 99% of the time. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what to hit, I tell young dudes, if you don't know what your play is, just knock somebody in their ass. The coach will be like, you didn't get the right guy, but you killed somebody. We can work with that opposed from, you know, fucking guys hopping around, standing up, looking, you know, looking around like your head on a swivel. But no, man, it's really frustrating for me seeing almost like, and I'll use the word, like it just feels backwards, like in terms of developing. And like you said, dude, we're seeing it with the Patrick Mahomes. I watched clips of the kid who I think he was the top high school quarterback recruit, is like an Olympic volleyball player. And no when you watch the kid, he plays down in Long Beach out in California. They were showing him at a seven.
Yeah, he's going to Tennessee.
Dude, they were watching him, or I watched some clips of him playing 7-on-7. The kid's like 6'6", 6'7". He rolled out, and as he rolled out, he came across his body, and he brought the ball up so high, almost like he was going to spike. And he threw the ball like with a jump on like a downward angle, and just threw this fucking laser beam like 50 yards to the point where I was like, I've never seen a quarterback do that. I've never seen a quarterback get into that position, turn his hips, bring the ball up. Because for the most part, they bring it to the ear and it basically comes out like a shotgun shell. And he brought it up and was able to whip the ball from this position as he jumped. And I'm like, oh shit. Like that was pretty fucking cool. Like, you know, but what do they say? He's one of the top volleyball, Olympic level volleyball players. And he's real good at football too. And I just was like, dude, you're basically hindering these kids' athletic performance and development by almost selfishly forcing them to do this, like you were saying. It just seems really ass backwards to me.
Yeah, one of the most important things for my own development as a football player, I think, came on the basketball court. Like, I was a big basketball AAU guy through high school. I hit 6'7" when I was 14, so I kind of thought, like, hey, I'm going to be playing in the NBA, and then I stopped growing. But doing a sport where you jump and you learn explosive hips, knees, and ankles – and how to move in space, how to control your body when you're going to the rim. Like, those were things that directly made me a better offensive lineman. Things that you wouldn't learn as an offensive lineman. You don't jump as an offensive lineman, but you create explosion, you create speed, you create power, the ability to create force through the ground and through your ankles and balance that it takes, and body control on the basketball court. And then it carries over to the football field. And if you tried to do that in a drill form, you wouldn't get the same thing out of it because it's not competitive. I think you have to make something competitive to be able to get the most out of somebody when they're doing that training. And the only way to get something out of your training is if you're training at almost your max at all times.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier you created your own technique by looking at the body moved, and we made a connection to your shot put, that body awareness and the importance. Did you ever try to mentor and teach one of your teammates like how to think, especially over the 11-year career when a young guy came in with that potential?
Yeah, so I picked up yoga my third year in the NFL, and I think that was a huge thing for me, helping my mobility, because I'm a very stiff-jointed person in general, which is good. It makes you explosive, it makes you fast, but it also makes you injury-prone. And as an offensive lineman, you don't want to get hurt. So picked up the yoga, but I think the best thing I got from yoga was the mindset and the mind muscle connection. Because in football, it's just a meathead football coach going, faster, harder, you know, you never slow things down and you don't realize that your mind doesn't know the difference between full speed and half speed and walkthrough speed. It just knows you're going through the patterns. And so slowing things down and understanding how my brain can tell all these tiny little muscles to work together, learning the sequencing, is something that I picked up in yoga and was able to transfer it to the football field, so that if a coach told me, hey, I want you to bend your left ankle a little bit more, I want you to roll your knee in just a little bit more on your left side, like whatever he told me, I could do it immediately. Whereas so many guys have like a wall in their brain because they don't know how to do that. They don't know how to tell their brain to tell their muscles how to work differently. And so yoga really helped with that mind muscle connection, but shot put was huge for me, learning the technique that I kind of developed for myself with the vertical set, with the pass set, because it's very similar. You use your inside leg, you're pushing off your inside leg, you're pushing off with the ball and your big toe on your inside foot, and you're gripping the ground like an eagle would grip like a branch. So you're creating tension in the bottom of your foot, and then you're exploding off. And you're kicking with your other leg. So it's a push and a pull. You push with your inside and you're pulling with your outside leg.
Is that called, is that called the glide? The glide.
Yes.
Versus and the rotation, the spin?
Versus, yeah, rotation or spin. And I thought to myself, okay, who are the fastest people in the world with a kick set? Well, be a glide shot putter, right? Because that's all they do. And you select for the greatest, fastest gliders because they're able to create the most force and to throw the shot put the farthest. And I saw what they were doing, and I was like, well, maybe I should be doing that, because the number one most important thing for an offensive tackle when you pass it is, how quickly can I get back in that first kick? Sure. Because if that guy gets ahead of me on my first kick, it's already over. Now I'm out of balance, and I'm trying to catch up, and he's already a better athlete than me.
And you got to cross over and step in the bucket, and then you're screwed.
Yeah. And it's a nightmare. Yeah. And you'll lose every time. And so I realized that, hey, if I win the set, if I beat my man to the spot every single time, I'm going to win. And even if the guy's bigger than me, I'm going to be able to sink my hips and absorb him if he bull rushes, as long as I'm able to recognize it. But if I beat him to the spot, I have the upper hand almost every time, and I'm going to win. And so that's kind of how my own technique developed in my mind. And then, like I said, especially towards the end of my career, I love teaching. I love coaching. I get such enjoyment out of seeing a guy that's struggling with something, giving him one or two cues or something to think about, and then seeing him make progress. And so I love doing that at the end of my career. And that's why I'm coaching fourth and fifth grade track athletes right now in the shot put and discus. That's why I got our sports advantage facilities. That's why I train a group of 15 old guys, because it's fun. I love coaching. I love using this knowledge that I've been blessed with from playing 11 years in the NFL and 20 years total of football, and thinking about things differently than just how the coach told me, to be able to give that gift to so many other people is really why I feel like I found passion and joy in retirement, where a lot of other guys, they struggle because they just don't have that sense of purpose, I think, when they retire from the NFL.
Well, there's an interesting transition piece between like I was a star, I was an athlete, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, the job ends, and a lot of guys try to hang on too long instead of pivoting into something that looks like either teaching or mentoring, or what can I do to bring people along and give people a greater opportunity to succeed? And I think the sooner you get into that, and you know, I firmly believe that you get a chance to live many lifetimes in the case of this lifetime, you know, like the fact that I got to live and, you know, play in the NFL for a decade and do that, and then it ended, and I was fine to be like, that was one lifetime, this is my next. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine to take and I almost look at it like a separate life. I run into a lot of guys that like can't detach or can't, you know, put it to bed or fucking bury it. And I'm like, dude, like it never goes away, but you're not going to be able to jumpstart it again. And living in the past just makes you really fucking anxious and depressed. So, you know, live in the present, and what can you glean from it? What can you do? And I really think it's teaching, it's mentoring, and it's allowing people to, you know, do the best they can with the information that you're providing them based on your experiences. And I think the sooner you get to do that, man, the more rewarding it becomes. And then also it allows you to look back very favorably on it and be like, hey, I did this. Because, I mean, there's a lot of bullshit. There's injuries. There's a lot of stuff. And I do run into a lot of dudes that are extremely bitter. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, that's all just your perception of how you viewed it.
Yeah, you know? And, so much.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure you run into guys that are like, oh, I'm like, hey, dude, you know, and I can think of Kyle Turley being like, you know, if I had known it was going to cause this much pain, I would have never have done it. And he asked me, I'm like, 100 times over, I would have done this. Mm-hmm. And all the scars and the pains and the injuries and all the other BS, like, I would never trade any of this for the for not, you know, the experience that we had, dude. Like, this is the greatest point. We were like Jolly Green Giants walking the earth. I got a chance to play every Sunday in white spandex in front of millions of people. I mean, running out, like, it was great. It was an incredible deal. But, like, realize that that was one life, and now you're into your next, and you can have this, like, almost the memory of a past life to guide you in your present.
Beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's great. Dude, I'm so stoked that you found that. That's inspiring, and it's great to see.
Yeah, as a bald guy, I feel like I can make fun of bald people, and I think I see NFL players' careers a lot like getting bald. Like, usually when you go bald, you're the last person to know that you're too bald to have a haircut. You're like living with the swoop for and the comb over for probably 2 or 3 years longer than you should, because you're not willing to accept the fact that, dude, you're bald. You got to just shave your head.
Just let it ride.
Just let it go. That's the same thing with NFL careers. Your identity has been wrapped up forever as a football player, and you're the last one to realize that you can't do it anymore, and you don't want to accept the fact that you're not good enough to do it. And I feel very lucky that as an offensive lineman, we didn't have as much of our ego and identity wrapped up into being a football player and what that means, not only on the field, but off the field with money and relationships and access and all the things that come with being a professional athlete that are pretty nice, like realizing that at some point it's going to end. And a lot of times for most guys, it's not going to end very well. But understanding that that was my identity then, and now I got to find a new identity and just be happy to look back, like you said, on the career and feel fortunate that you were able to play a kid's game for a king's ransom with your best friends for however long you got to do. And I think realizing that, hey, no matter what happens, I'm not going to bring it back to life. I loved when you said that.
Well, the other thing too is going forward without regrets. That's another big one that I always think about. Like, it's always nice to, you know, you'll see this at the Hall of Fame, which, dude, congratulations. I'm so stoked for you.
Thank you. Thank you, man.
I was going to ask you a little bit about your speech and how much you've worked on it, but like showing up there and like seeing contemporaries and guys you played, and then people, you know, like playing the game the way that you should have played, and having dudes be like, man, I didn't like playing against you, or, you know, like some of that, like being able to relive this. I remember, I ran into Leroy Glover. There was like an NFL deal that I got invited to. It was kind of like just a post-retirement. Like, they were had a bunch of speakers, and I went to, and Leroy was there, and he rolls up to me and he's like, you're the only motherfucker I know here. And, and then it was funny because there was a bunch of like 1 and 2 and 3 year guys. And I just happened to be Atlanta. I just went to this deal, and, he was, you know, sitting there. It was nice to sit there and just bullshit with one of the contemporaries and just be like, man, like, I didn't enjoy playing against you. You played the game harder, you know? And like, I was like, dude, I thought the same for you. Shit, man, you were a rocket ship. So it's nice to run in and get validation. Like, I don't get validation from fans or anything else, but it's nice to, you know, years later to run into contemporaries that are like, dude, you played the game the way it should have been. Mm-hmm. For me, that is always been a marker of great success. Whereas, you know, I run into some other guys, I'm like, that guy sucked. I don't know. Like, and my wife constantly laughs. She's like, how in the NFL did dudes suck? And I'm like, there's very many classes in the NFL. There were like starters, there were backups, and there were some starters that were just keeping positions warm. And there were other dudes that walked the fucking walk for 10 years and did it the way they should have been done. And there was a very, very real, and the dudes that played the game, they knew exactly who those people were. So.
Got a few fun questions here.
Ooh. Do you think Joe's a funny guy? Do you think he's into having
fun? Here we go.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's a fun guy. Let's do it.
Let's do it, man.
All right.
Cracking some beers.
Did you ever have a play in which you were eligible? And did you actually go out in the route? Because I hear John just chose to stay in and block on his eligible.
I was not into that life of high pressure touchdown catches. And so I was much happier to be the blocker and to not have the whole world laughing at me when I dropped a pass that was wide open in the end zone.
Dude, we played against Indy in the playoffs, and Willie Rofe ended up not playing. Back was hurt, didn't want to play. Put in his backup, who wasn't ready to play against Dwight Freeney. First round of the playoffs in Indianapolis in the playoffs.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah. It was a legitimately bad deal. And so I'm playing right tackle, and all of a sudden I see my backup come running on the field. And I'm like, he's like, you're playing left tight end. Now, mind you, we hadn't run this at all. Like, we hadn't practiced this at all. And, you know, thank God I know the playbook. Like, that was one of my deals where, I like to, like the first day when they give us a playbook, I basically try to memorize everything I could, because I wanted, like, when somebody asked a question, I wanted to be like the person to answer the obscure thing to make everybody think I was probably way smarter than I was. But I pretty much knew the routes in this. So I end up going left tight end, tackle eligible. And they were like, hey, you're supposed to be running this and this. We're going to stay in a block. I want you to just take a shot on Freeney. So we did that for a few series. And then all of a sudden you got to take a shot, and I need you to basically like an up and over. And I'm literally running, and I'm just praying to God, don't throw me the fucking ball. Bob Sanders and these dudes were absolutely going to decimate me, and thank God they didn't throw me the ball. You know, my hands are taped. I'm pretty much casted up.
You look like a Ninja Turtle.
Yeah, like there's no way that I'm going to be able to catch this thing. I can't lift my arms because obviously my shoulder pads are too tight. My jersey's like all fucking wrong as I'm just running. So, I thank God they didn't throw me the ball.
John mentioned Freeney. I imagine he's one of those opponents. Who's your favorite opponent or list of? And then – I know John always wanted to go against a J.J. Watt. Is there a dude now? So the sub question, is there a dude now playing that you would love to line up against?
Well, I didn't like lining up against the good players because those are the guys I lost the most sleep over. The Dwight Freeneys, the DeMarcus Wares, the Terrell Suggs, James Harrison, those guys, I mean, they made you work. It was a lunch pail type day when you went against those guys because – they were bringing their best, and they weren't worried about the run. Like, all they were trying to do was sack the quarterback, so it didn't feel fair because you had to play the game the way it was supposed to be played, and all those guys were cared about was getting their sacks. So those guys are kind of a nightmare. And in today's game, I'm trying to think, like, I played against Myles Garrett. We were on the team together in Cleveland his rookie year, and he was a beast, man, and he's only gotten better. Like, his first step – is among the quickest in the game. He's like 280 pounds, 6'4". He can bend like Gumby, get around the corner. He can put his foot in the ground, and the way his ankles bend and he's able to snap back and create power off the outside of his shoe is just ridiculous. So he'd be another guy in today's game that I definitely wouldn't want to see. I like those easy games where you walk away and you get 100%. You get like the check mark. Great game, Joe. Your guy never got anywhere near the quarterback. You did well. You're barely sore. You're ready to go and train hard on a Monday.
Oh, shit, dude. fuck, every week it was like somebody was an all pro. I always hope to, play the best player in the world, but I just wanted to catch him on his worst day.
I
was like, man, I want to play against the, you know, the best player on the biggest day on the greatest stage and have him just have an off day. So I used to joke with my brother. He'd be like, I was watching, went pretty well. I'm like, I caught him on his off days. He's like, man, you've been catching dudes on their off days for 10 years. I'm like, oh, thank God. Because I know what it's like to catch somebody on their on day. And you're like, this ain't a fucking bad day. But I've told Tex this. I cannot stand the way that they would like the accolades and just the J.J. Watt love that would come from Gruden. And it drove me fucking crazy because, one, he never had a responsibility. He would shoot gaps that had extra dudes. He fucking left guys hanging out. He had contained. He would go inside. He pretty much was so undisciplined. Yeah, undisciplined. Yeah, you said undisciplined. I was going to say unorthodox and try to be nice, but it fucking drove me absolutely crazy. And then he would do some ass wet backwards shit that just happened to work out. And then you would hear Gruden go, J.J., what? And I'd be like, I would have fucking love to have played against him. Just for the fact that I would have just tried to fucking light him up. I got a chance to play against Bruce Smith and Jason Taylor. Mm-hmm. I mean, Warren Sapp, all these dudes that I got to play against. And I'm sad. The other one, which was funny, I was in a production meeting in Philly, and Howie Long came in, and we were doing the production meeting, and he was talking to me, and he's sitting there with his glasses, you know, Howie's over there trying to pretend he's fucking not Howie Long. And we started talking about something, and I was like, you know what my biggest regret is? That I'm not a little bit older, because I would have loved to have played against you. And his whole fucking demeanor changed.
He was like, what?
He was like, what?
And, nobody's ever said that.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. No, fucking, nobody's ever said that. Nobody went on. I was like, you know, my biggest regret is that I didn't get to fucking play against you. I would have loved to have played it lined up. And I swear to God, dude, like, if it had gone on 2 seconds longer, we probably would have ended up doing one-on-one pass pro in the fucking production meeting. He was still, like, they only had him listed at, like, 6'4", and I'm 6'5 and 3/4". Like, I'm just a hair under 6'6", barefoot, so 6'6 with shoes. And I thought he was taller than me.
Dang.
I mean, he was at least 6'5", 6'6". I mean, we were looking eye to eye, and like all of a sudden we stood up and things got real tense, and they were like, holy shit. So it's that was, you know, I didn't get to play against Howie, and I didn't get to play against J.J. Watt, so I would have liked to play against those two guys.
All right, last one here. Favorite football movie of all time?
I think it's Varsity Blues for me. That was kind of in that era, generation when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And as a high school football player in Wisconsin, you dreamed of playing like under the bright lights of Texas football, where, you know, the whole town was there, because we just didn't really have that experience growing up in Wisconsin like kids do growing up and playing in any city in Texas, or really across the South for that matter. But also the shenanigans that they got into made us high school boys pretty jealous. So I think I can't wait till my son's old enough where I can show him Varsity Blues. And I want to see if he enjoys it the same way that I did when I was in high school.
Nice. Any Given Sunday. It's a game of inches.
Oh, the speech.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Varsity Blues got a good speech, but it came from the backup quarterback.
Well,
Vanderbeek.
He lives here in Austin. Uh-huh. He came, so my we have a cancer charity, Wade's Army. We raise money for neuroblastoma, and we had a event. We live next door here on the ranch. We live next door to BK Riding School. So Kathy has like 60 horses and has 300 kids a day come in, and they basically, you know, like hunter jumpers and equestrian deal. And so we had like a big kind of rodeo where they had like a bull ride and pony rides and stuff. So it was one of the charity things that we did for Wade's Army. And he showed up with his wife and like they have like 6 or 7 kids.
Well, it's a good thing I wasn't there. I would have been quoting the movie. I don't want your life.
I saw him, and like it's kind of a weird deal where like what do you like? I don't know. Probably different for you, or maybe the same. But, like, if somebody wants to come over and talk to me about football, I'm sure you do. I'm happy to talk to him about football.
Yeah.
Like, he was there. I didn't know if it was, like, should I go over there and be like, you know, and I did. I walked over and said, hey, man, thanks for coming. Nice to meet you. And just, like, let him go. What I didn't want to do is that guy that comes over and is like, I'm sure you've had guys come over and be like, all right, let me tell you about my high school football career. Because I get it all the time where these guys start telling me about their high school football success. And I'm like, sounds amazing, dude. I hope you slayed it. But he was there. And I also – and you have 4 kids. I got 3. Like, you're in that situation because he had a stroller and this. Like, I should have just rolled over and been like, you need a drink, dude. You got, like, 5 kids here that are all running around. Your wife's got, like, this big Zac Brown hat on. That just looked like a lot of work.
You remember that whipped cream bikini? That was awesome.
It'd be even greater if you came out with that on.
As a fan.
You're like, and then McQuilkin. You're like, Yeah,
that would have been awesome.
Yeah, but, that's my story on him. He seems like a nice dude. He just looked like a dad that was overwhelmed by 5 kids at a rodeo that he didn't want to be at.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's like, my wife dragged me to this. He's like, can I get a drink?
Nice. Well, in line with speeches, is there any like coach that gave a pregame speech? Is pregame speeches the way it's portrayed in film at the professional level?
My favorite pregame speech was when our coach didn't even bother us before the game, and I could just study my notes and I could think about the guy I had to go against and I could focus on my job. Because maybe if you're a high school kid, you need some motivation because you're just a little tired. You're thinking about something else. You're distracted about homecoming that night. But like in the NFL, I had a lot of shit in my life that was going on that I had to think about that was really important, that I needed to go out and fucking bust my ass and play as well as I possibly could. So I needed to use the little brain that I had in my head to focus all of it on being ready for all the little one-offs that happen when you're an offensive lineman, all those ghosts that you chase all week and you think about, like, if this happens, this is what we're going to do. And so I needed all that focus right there, and I didn't want our head coach to come in, who probably didn't even play college football, to come be a hard ass and tell me how you need to fucking run through the wall and kick somebody's ass.
I'm with you. I'm in the same right, dude. I was never big on rah-rah speeches. And actually, early in my career in Philly, I coined a little phrase that said, in the absence of true leadership, false prophets appear. Because what happened was, is when all of a sudden you didn't have good leadership, dudes would just like start pontificating and like making fucking preposterous claims and wanting to bring fucking people into the shower to have these talks. And I'd be like, shut the fuck up. I don't want to go in the shower and listen to your rah-rah bullshit. And I fucking hated it. I was never big on rah-rah speeches. And I don't know if you were like this as well. did you play for offensive line coaches that when you came over to the sideline, all of a sudden started trying to like scream and yell, and they're shown there with their drawings and this. And I tell these dudes all the time, I'm like, if you're fucking coaching on the sideline on a Sunday, you're fucked. You didn't do what you needed to do. And I would just get up and walk away. Cause I'm like, dude, like, we've prepared all week. What are you going to do? Like, if anything, if we sit down and you show me the printouts and you're like, hey, they're doing this, we didn't see this, and you're giving me actually actionable feedback, like, hey, we're going to make this modification, they're doing something different than we thought, now we're going to do this. But then when guys are, you know, coaches are over there screaming at young dudes and trying to get them to coach technique or this and this, I just get up and walk the fuck away. Just because I hated it. And I tell these guys all the time, I don't want to be in a foxhole with you. If there's bullets coming, I'm not living in a foxhole with you. Get the fuck away from me.
It's such an energy sap when you're sitting on the sideline reliving every single play that you just did, and your emotions are high. You're in that fight or flight mode, and you're thinking about all the shit that just happened instead of what's going to happen. Like, I understand if there's an adjustment and we're going to do something differently, we need to get on the same page. But other than that, I hated the coaches that wanted to make everybody gather around. Let's look at every look the defense gave us. I'm like, if I fuck something up and I didn't know about it, tell me about it. Otherwise, I'll be sitting on the end of the bench. I'm going to have my eyes closed. I'm going to be working on my breath to get my heart rate under control so I can recover and think about when I have to go back out there and block fucking Dwight Freeney with snot bubbles coming out of his nose the next play. But you, I'm over here on the sideline getting all worked up, getting me all worked up and emotionally drained. That's doing nothing but harming my ability to go out and do my job in the next series.
Thank God. Amen. God, I hated those dudes. Chris has heard me say this forever, dude. Like, if you got to coach me on Sunday, we've already failed. And
yeah, it's already over. You've already lost.
Yeah, we've already lost. Like, just go out there and, like, let playmakers be playmakers. Like, go out there and fucking run 100 miles an hour. You guys know what to do. You're professionals. Go do the job. And I tell young dudes, you're professional. Go out there and do your fucking job. If you don't, we're getting new people in there. And, like, that was always my attitude. Like, I'll do it as long as I can. The day that I can, just tell me, and I'll go do something else.
Yep.
And then at the end, I'm like, I could have just stolen for another year and been like a good rock room guy.
Just stick me in IR.
Yeah, no, I was like, just have you be me like the older guy that mentors the young dudes. And they were like, nah, fuck you. We ain't doing that. You either playing or you're not. So it ends. What is it? It ends whenever it ends. So you got?
I got a full sheet here. This is good. This is great.
No, it's great, dude. Joe, the one thing which is universally true is usually when I run into other offensive linemen, they're usually pretty cerebral, pretty smart, good conversationalists, like to have a good sense of humor, and for the most part, pretty good dudes. So thank you for keeping my batting average at 1,000.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, man. It's been a fun time reliving some of the glory days, and you're exactly right. Just a couple little Hall of Fame events that I've gone to, the one group that always finds each other, it's all linemen. And it's just like this for 90 minutes, a couple hours, because we've always saw the game and life the same way. And I think the transition's been very similar, and it's great getting back together. So thanks for having me on the show today, guys.
Yeah, well, thank you. Awesome. And if you're ever in Austin, Texas, or we're in Madison, Wisconsin, I'll reach out and I'll buy you that beer.
I can't wait. Beer, and then you buy me some barbecue when I'm down in Texas.
If you come to Texas, I will take you on a barbecue tour. I got
– Can't wait.
Yeah, like you got to like live here for a little bit, because there's a lot of places that the tourists would go to that we know some other spots. So I'd love to.
Oh, man. That's awesome. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it, dude. Best
Joe, if people want to follow the journey and help celebrate the Hall of Fame, where should they go? Great.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and Instagram now, at JoeThomas73. Pretty simple. I also pump my athletic youth performance center, Sports Advantage. I got a farm. We sell beef, grass-raised, a little bit of corn to finish, so that it tastes good.
What's the name of your farm? And do you guys do like
Six Springs
boxes?
Farm. We're still growing. Like, we only are raising about 20 steers a year right now, and we're just supplying restaurants in Madison. But shipping beef across state lines, I've realized, is a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping to continue to grow the brand and figure out a way that it can make sense, because everybody that's had a chance to taste the beef is like, wow, this is like some different shit right here. I'm like, well, yeah, because I don't care how much it costs me to raise it. I'm trying to raise the best beef I can, because I don't need the money from the beef. But what I want to do is to raise my own meat, because it's important to me to eat good shit.
Dude, I could not agree more. We have Stay Classy Meats sends us a ton of buffalo and stuff from Montana. And then there's an amazing 5,000 acre ranch just about an hour and a half south of here called Augustus Ranch that I've gone down and visited with the owners, taken me, looked at all the herds, explained to me why everything that they do, they don't do any genetic modification. Everything they grow is within their own stuff and has been there for years. And
that's awesome.
Like if I can show up and be impressed by that deal, I'm stoked, man. So that's badass. I'm stoked you're doing that.
That's awesome, man. I'll leave you with this, guys. Food is medicine. Took me way too long to figure that out, but that's how I live my life now. So
I think that's Socrates.
Socrates. Sun Tzu, I think he said it right in the Art of War somewhere.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. Another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Bye.
See ya.